I'm your host, Jeff Dawson, for another episode of Dawson's Domain, where we cover the spectrum of life's pressing issues and events, from politics to relationships, sports to horror, alternative history to poetry, humor to baseball coaching, and everything in between. Good afternoon. This is Jeff Dawson of Dawson's Domain out of Dallas, Texas. The topic today is going to be relationships and cancer, of which I have sadly, a lot of experience with. And I've written three books on it. Why Did Everything Happen? Love's True Second Chance and Living with Breast Cancer. These are all available on Amazon, or you can find them at jeffdawsonauthor.site. If you have any questions that you'd like to ask me during the show, male or female, you can call in at 888-627-6008 or 323-744-4831. About a month ago, because I want to give a shout out here, I did a show with Wayne Clark and his fiance Nicole on The Right Buzz, and he's out of England, and we talked about this topic for an hour. When it comes to relationships and cancer, it's really a very trying experience if you haven't gone through it. I lost my partner in our construction company in 1990, my father in 2005, and then the love of my life, Debbie Beck Larson, in 2009. Each one had a different form of cancer. But when it came to being with them and helping them, it's really tough. My partner was the first one. He had was diagnosed with colon cancer and went in, had the surgery, and everything was good. They gave him a really good prognosis, but then a couple of months later, he went back and they diagnosed him with inoperable liver cancer. And Larry and I talked about it. How are we going to deal with this? And I told him, look, you work as long as you can until the day that you tell me I can't go any farther. And that's what he did. And I can still remember that, even though it was 30 years ago, we were doing a job north of downtown Dallas on Hall Street. We're setting forms, and Larry stood up, just looked me in the eye, and he goes, I can't do it anymore. And I said, okay, that's fine. Let's see what you can do. Go home and get some rest, but you will still be paid. And that was the right thing to do. Now, not being a family member, there wasn't a lot of care I could give him. But I would stop by at least twice a week. We'd play a game of chess. And it was really tough to watch him start to deteriorate. I mean, if you've never been around this, when cancer gets a hold of somebody, Larry probably weighed 180 pounds, 190, real good shape. I mean, he'd had a really tough life. He'd been in an accident when he was a teenager or in his early teens with his brother, and his brother lost his life. They were hit head-on US 175 or CFON Freeway in Dallas, and his brother died, and his leg was all messed up. And back then, the surgical techniques weren't the best in town, but they did what they could. So we always walked with a limp, but he always had a great attitude. I mean, he's just one of those guys that you hear about, but you never get a chance to meet. And I was very fortunate that we had worked together at a previous company, Angel Concrete. They closed their doors. I decided to start my own company. and he wanted to be a part of it. And we did this for like a year and a half. But as cancer progressed, he wound up in a hospital bed. And once he hit that bed, I mean, it was bad. He was the one that loses all the weight, can't do anything for himself, has 24-hour full-time care, and that was really tough. I really hated to see him go. He's one of those guys that you look around and go, why Larry? It didn't make any sense. And I go through that, and why did everything happen? Now, my father, things didn't go well in Dallas, and I was forced to regroup, sell everything, and move back home. When I got back to Tulsa, I'd heard from my mom and my sister and niece that, and even my dad, that things are good and he's doing okay. Well, I wasn't there all the time. So let's see what's going on. We got up there. We took a trip to Oklahoma City to see his oncologist. And something wasn't right. You could tell something wasn't right. We go to the appointment, and I'm watching the doctors. There's three of them. And they're pointing at Dad. They're really not saying much. Any of you actually been to one of these doctor appointments where you know they're not telling you everything that's on their mind and everything they know? Well, I could see it in their eyes. So the appointment ended. My niece and my dad walk out, no big deal. I start walking around the hospital in the doctor's office looking for those three. I found them in a little cubbyhole. And I guess they're going over Dad's chart. And I said, okay, the gig's up. And this is the way you got to talk to doctors. You can't beat around the bush. You can't act like everything's okay, because you know damn good and well it's not. And I looked at him and said, all right, I want to know exactly what's going on. You thought I'd have slapped them across the face or something. I said, I need to know, where are we at? What's going on with him? What can I expect? They said, you really want the truth? And I said, no, I'm standing here like a dumbass. Of course I want the truth. I need to know what the hell's going on with my dad. I said, you saw the purple spots on his chest? And I said, I did. And obviously you've seen the lesions on his face. And I said, yes, I've been treating them. They go, well, that's the cancer. I said, okay. Your dad made it very clear that he doesn't want to go through chemo and radiation. And I said, yeah, he's in his mid-80s. He's watched his friends go through that treatment, and their quality of life just disappeared. It was nothing. They didn't have a quality of life. Well, he's told us that he doesn't want to go through that. And I said, yes, and he's got 7 months to live. I said, okay. And it was their look in their eyes that I'll always remember. And it wasn't deer in the headlights, but it was damn close to it. So for the next 7 months, I got to do what my parents had done for 40 plus years. And because we're always our parents' children. I mean, we could be 80 and our parents are 100 and we're still their children. I got to return everything that he had done for me in my 40 plus years. I got to take care of my dad, and I got to spend quality time with him. This was good, because unlike Larry, when Dad's cancer kept progressing. It didn't immobilize him. He didn't lose his faculties. Now, we did get hospice care. And when the nurse showed up, again, I needed to know what to expect. I already know what the doctors have told me. Now, this gal is going to show up. I think she showed up at least once or twice a week. And we went through all of his medications. I mean, he had one of those massive pill boxes, you know, Monday through Saturday. And he had like 15 pills in there. And she pulled out the list and said, no, doesn't need this, doesn't need this. And I forgot all the medications he was on, but it was just it was like candy is what it looked like. I said, okay, now I don't understand the type of cancer my father has, because it was in his upper chest, in his neck, and on his face. She said, well, you want to know the worst case scenario? And I said, yes. And I'm telling you, folks, if you have a loved one that has cancer, you've got to ask these hard questions so you know what to expect. She said, it's rare, but in the type your dad has, it can eat through the skin, as you've seen on his face, and it can rupture a carotid artery. So make sure you have black plastic bags on hand. And I was like, okay. And that is for, she goes, if that artery ruptures, you're going to want something on the floor because you're not going to be able to stop it. Well, that was a little different, okay? But I got the black plastic bags. She told me how to treat all the lesions on his face and his neck, which they never really irritated him. They didn't bother him. But the chance of infection was very high because his body is trying to fight off the cancer. And if he gets an infection, that's going to go downhill real fast. And that was not going to be good. But she prepared me for the worst. So then I could relay that information to my mom, my niece, and my sister. Of course, they kind of looked at me like I was nuts. And I said, look, this is what she said. And this is what we have to get ready for. But in the meantime, we aren't going to stop living. And this is one thing I can't stress enough. If your loved one does have cancer, you don't just shut down and go to the house and pack it in. You've got to continue to live. And in this case, mom and dad were both in their mid-80s. The house was in relative disrepair. So my son and I, because he came back with me, we took over the household. And don't be afraid to do this. You know, you will meet resistance. Believe me, I met resistance from my mom and my dad over this. But when you look around and you see a month's worth of laundry, the house hasn't been properly cleaned in God knows how long. So I had a long chat with my sister and my niece over this little fiasco. You've got to jump in there and you've got to take hold of the situation. There's no time to debate the issues. They might not like what you're going to do, and they might not completely understand it, but it's something you have to do. Go in there and start getting the house in shape. So I know my dad's going to pass in 7 months. This is a given. My mom, when I got up there, She had two broken hips, so she was in a pretty nice nursing home. In that first, I guess she was in there a couple of months. The first couple of months, every day, I'd load Dad up. I'd take him over there to go see her. He was even thinking of moving into the place, which, hey, if Dad, you got to do what you got to do. If you think you're going to be happier there, but if you do that, then there is a lot of work that's got to be done to your all's house if this is what you want to do, and sell it. So while he would visit Mom, my son Sean and I did exactly that. We started repairing things that needed to be fixed, whether it was the fence, it was doors, leaky faucets, you name it. And then we organized the house. When I say organized, I mean everything. We're just not talking about the little stuff and, well, this is a little cluttered. No, we went into the cabinets. We went into the pantry. And I had a trash can there and just started going through the cans. Expired, expired, expired. It's like, good Lord, is anything in this pantry edible? Of course, when Dad found out, because he was there for one of the episodes, Jeffrey, why are you throwing that out? And I said, Dad, it's 8 years expired, okay? And the can has kind of popped a little. That's a good sign. Well, I can't taste anything. So I said, no, Dad, you're not eating this. And so we cleaned everything out. Yeah, that means just you name it. The garage we had to go through, the sheds we had to go through. But it wasn't a burden. It's something that we as children owe our parents. I mean, look how long they took care of us. So this was going to be my small repayment for all the love and kindness they had showed me through the years. Now, as I said earlier, it ain't always easy. My mom and I, we locked horns on just about everything. She didn't like someone coming in and taking over her household. Well, you know something? You're in a wheelchair. You have a 2,200 square foot home. It's got four bedrooms. It's got 2.5 baths. It has, it's an old house. It had a formal living room and a formal dining room. Then you had the den and the TV. Then you had the kitchen and breakfast area and a laundry room. Now, how are you going to take care of that in a wheelchair? No. Yeah, that gave her a little different perspective. I'm not going to say she was excited about it. But then, guess who's got to fix breakfast, lunch, and dinner? You can't do it in a wheelchair. And luckily, as a single parent, I had learned to cook. Excuse me. So I had no problem taking over the reins, finding out what each one of them liked to eat. With Dad, it wasn't hard because he'd already gone through some radiation therapy years ago. I forgot where exactly what. I think it was one of the cancers in his neck. And he'd kind of lost his taste buds. That was okay. But he still had his favorites. And I didn't have a problem cooking for him or cleaning. My son and I took over that household. Now, it took 3 months at least to get everything in shape to where, okay, if they have to sell the house in a short span of time, we've got it to where at least it's clean. So when a realtor comes in, it's just not a disaster. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, tearing out carpets and anything like that or repainting. Because when it comes to a realtor, they're looking at the, you know, at the shell itself. They don't care about the furniture. They're looking at the living space, looking at how the house is laid out, and that's what they're going to sell to a potential buyer. Color of carpet, color of paint, all that. Hey, there, do not mess with any of that stuff, because your new buyers might not like it. In fact, when I was in my teens, Carl Hall, who lived across the street, was a home builder, and that was one of the biggest things he always complained about, was the little things that it took to sell a house or not sell a house. And he would put, because back in the, this was back in the 70s, so shag carpet, for those of you that don't know, man, this was the biggest thing. You had it in houses, you had it in these fun vans. Yeah, those were fun vans. But it'd be the color. They didn't like the color of the carpet. They liked the style, but they didn't like the color. Or they didn't like the paint in one room, and he would accommodate them. He'd say, okay, I'll put this color carpet down, and then I'll go in and I'll paint this room. But that's what that buyer wanted. That doesn't mean every buyer is going to like that, because we're all different. So the house, we got in shape. I did everything I could with my dad as long as he wanted to. Every morning he wanted to take a walk. Okay, Dad, let's take a walk. He couldn't go far, but it was a walk. And even with his diagnosis, Dad was the top-notch explosives expert for EI DuPont for 20 years. Dad always had a go-to attitude. And one of his was he always wanted to make money, because he was from the Depression era, so he was always worried that if he died first, Mom wouldn't have enough money to live. Well, Dad and Mom had done some really good financial planning, and they had a real good war fund, war chest built up. But that didn't stop him, even with his cancer, from trying to find some products to get into and sell. And back then, it was phone service. Everybody had a cheaper phone service. In fact, Dad wanted me to actually go to one of the stores and hand out cards. And I said, have you talked to the store owners about this? He said, no, there won't be a problem. I said, Dad, there's going to be a problem. You're on their property. You have to get permission from the store. Now, needless to say, that didn't happen. So when we couldn't do that, he got his walker and went around the neighborhood. And I went with him. It was great. But the best times that I got to spend with him was, he'd built a game room and had an adjoining porch. And I smoke, and Dad liked going out on the porch, so we would go out there and just talk. It didn't have to be deep discussions. It didn't have to be about world events. We just talked about the past. And one of the greatest stories that he told me, and I couldn't believe he never brought it up, because I already mentioned Debbie Beck. That was my dad's favorite of all of my girlfriends, including my fiance and my wife, ex-wife. This was his favorite. Well, Debbie and I had gone to Wendy's one night, and we had dinner. I think we're going to a movie, got out, and we got frisky, and I won't go into the details, but I wound up backing in to this guy's car. And I swear, I looked both ways. To this day, I looked both ways, and I didn't see that damn car behind me. And I bumped into it my bumper, and I've got an F100 Ford into his. It could have been an Impala or something, but the height was right, so I just did his bumper. And he wants to exchange information, and needless to say, I'm not in a position to get out of my truck. Well, let your imagination figure out what we were doing in the Wendy's parking lot. Well, my best friend was Mike Palin. Sadly, I lost him in 2001. He had a massive heart attack. But I go over to see Mike, and his dad looks at me, asks me how I'm doing. Mr. Palin, I'm fine. No big deal. He starts asking me questions about this car. And it's like, I don't know what you're talking about. And he goes, well, I find that kind of funny because this guy I work with said a kid, a teenage boy with his girlfriend in a red Ford pickup backed into him, and that boy didn't want to get out of the truck. And I was like, oh, hell. Oh, hell no. This is too much of a coincidence. It was 30 years later, sitting on the back porch with my dad, and he looked me straight in the eye and he goes, Jeffrey, you remember about that guy? Remember backing into a guy at Wendy's parking lot? I was like, well, yeah, kind of. Why? I've known about it all along. I said, are you shitting me? You've known all these years? And he goes, yeah. Bill called up and was telling me about it. And I was like, oh, hell. What do you tell your dad? I couldn't believe he kept that in all those years. But that was the greatest part of being able to spend time with Dad. We got 7 months, like Larry. I mean, when he was diagnosed, he passed in 7 months from his liver cancer. Dad would pass February 15th of 2005. And that is my oldest son's birthday. So that's not a date we will forget anytime soon. But it was the time that we got to spend together and being able to take care of him, make sure he was comfortable, that he had everything he needed. I mean, how many of us wish that have lost our parents that we didn't spend enough time with them? I was fortunate. I wasn't fortunate that I went broke again and had to move back to Tulsa, but I was fortunate that I got to spend time that I would have never been allowed. Sure, we'd see each other on Thanksgiving, Christmas, Easter. Since I was a divorced parent, I'd take the kids up to Tulsa. They'd have them for 2 or 3 weeks and then we'd come back. But that was not quality time. We'd do a few things together. We might go to a movie, we might go to an amusement park, something like that. But to just hang out with Dad without the kids around, without Mom around, and just the daily activities, because he loved going to sporting events. And he kept going to high school football games long after I was gone. But that's what he did. He'd go to the Driller baseball games. He'd go to the Tournament of Champions basketball tournament at Oral Roberts. He'd go to all the Memorial High School's football games. He would not stay home. If there was a sporting event going on and the weather wasn't absolutely horrible, he would be there. Or if my children were there, he'd take them. He was always doing something. So there wasn't a lot of time to just sit and talk. I got that opportunity. I will always be grateful for that opportunity. And if your parents are getting up in their years and you don't think you really know them, I highly suggest getting reacquainted with them. In Dad's case, he had all of his mental faculties up until a week before he died, and I remember that night. He had his own TV room in my old bedroom, and he had to because his dad was deaf, and he had earphones where he could turn the TV volume all the way up. I mean, you could hear it halfway down the hall, but that's how much ear damage he got from being an explosives expert because they didn't have earplugs and ear protection like we do today. And OSU was playing OU. It was a basketball game. I forgot who won or who lost, but it didn't matter. Dad stood up as I was laying on the bed watching him, and I mean, he just fell over, bang. I called my son. We got him up, and I looked into his eyes. This is really disturbing. There was nothing there. He was alive, but there was nothing. That spark that always followed him around town, especially when he told his dirty jokes that my mom didn't like, I should get over it. It was gone. And I called the hospice nurse, and she said, he's got about a week. And he did. Now, during that week, he would fade in and out, but he was still 80% mentally there, which was a true blessing. And one day, my niece came in to wake me up. It'd been a long night. I mean, when you become a caregiver, folks, and y'all living in the same house, it becomes a 24/7 job. And getting sleep can be a real push. She said, something's wrong with Granddad. And I go, well, what's wrong? Well, he won't let me change him. And I said, why? Well, he says there's people in the room. I said, okay. What do you mean? Well, he says he's having a conversation. Okay. I'll handle it. When we become a caregiver, you better have a real open mind because you're going to run into things that are not in the book, and this was one of them. And I walked in there and I looked at Dad and I said, what's going on? He goes, well, son, I'm busy. And I go, well, I understand. You're having a conversation with friends, associates? And he goes, I am. And I said, okay, that's fine. Tell you what, you tell them to turn around and give us about 10 minutes to change you, clean you up, and give you your medicines, and you all can carry on with your discussion. He kind of looked at me and he goes, okay, I can do that. And he did. He said, all right, folks, take a break, go on. They got to tend to me. You could feel those people in the room. I'm not lying. You could feel an energy source all around the ceiling in that room. So we took care of him. We moved on. Dad went back to his discussion. We're in the den, and my niece and mom are talking about, well, he's hallucinating this, that. And I said, no, he's not. You didn't feel the energy in that room. His time's coming real fast. And they're paving the way for him. And he's not sad. He's excited. Didn't you see that? He actually had the twinkle back in his eye. He's ready for this. To this day, I don't think they believe me. But he did succumb to the cancer. But I got to know my dad again. I got to spend time with him. I remember I wrote him a letter. I guess I was in college, and he had saved it. I remember him pulling out of his wallet. I forgot what topic we were discussing. And he goes, "Here, remember this?" And I unfolded it. And it's like, "That's the letter I wrote you." He goes, "Yes." And I carry it in my wallet all the time. I was like, damn. That just floored me. I couldn't believe it. But this was the relationship that we were able to rekindle, and we were able to talk about all the stupid things I'd done, all the brilliant things I'd done, which that wasn't a whole lot, but, you know, we were all real brain surgeons in our teens and early 20s. Yeah, I know. But I got to know my dad again. My mom, that was going to take some time, because when I left Tulsa to take a job back in Dallas, all I'll say is it wasn't a cordial leave. We were just knocking heads. And luckily, it took a year and a half to get a job, you know, about 14 months after Dad had passed. Hell, I was trying to get jobs with Katrina work and you name it. I was trying to get it done and just couldn't land anything. And then within a month, I had two offers in Tulsa and I had two in Dallas, and I came back to Dallas. So let's get to the third person that I mentioned. So we've got Larry Smith, my partner. We got my dad, Ralph Dawson. Here comes Debbie Beck Larson. That was her married name. Debbie and I met in 1977 in high school. I was dating someone else at the time, so I really didn't understand that Debbie was interested in me, but she was. And it took a while for me to pull my head out and realize that the girl I was pursuing, that was a dead end. Nothing was going to come of it. I was actually told when we took a trip to Denver to play at a Broncos game, I was in the marching band, that she was only dating me until something better came along. Well, okay, but I wasn't giving up. Until I had asked this girl, I said, "We going out this weekend?" And she had to think about it. It was kind of like, well, I got to wash my hair, I got to brush my teeth. And I said, damn it, I've had enough. So I saw Debbie, went up the flight of stairs, and Debbie was with one of her friends. I just looked at her and I said, "You want to go out this weekend?" And I swear I heard her scream as I walked away. So we went out. And that's how we met. And it was the atypical high school sweetheart meeting. Not meeting, relationship. We were very much in love. You want to call it puppy love? You can call it what you want. But we were very much in love with each other. And yeah, even though I'm going on to be a senior, it's like, I'll marry this girl one day. Yeah, what do we know at 18? Well, I went to Oklahoma State. I was a year older than Debbie. And let's just say that she wanted a full-time boyfriend her senior year, and that wasn't going to happen with me being in college. And I saw the hints, I heard the rumors, I didn't believe them until I went to Tulsa. We went out to the 21st Street Bridge, and she gave my high school ring back, and I just about lost it. That was ugly. That was not a good breakup, I'll put it that way. She too would attend Oklahoma State. And we ran into each other four times. They were not happy reunions by any stretch of the imagination. None. Which I was pretty much at fault for that, because I was still pissed off. I'd been dumped like a bad habit. In December of 2008, my son was competing in a Muay Thai competition, my youngest. And I agreed to come up. It was a great competition. He won his fight. And I thought, okay, one more time, I'm going to put a business card in her parents' mailbox and maybe I'll hear from her. I did it. This would be the third time. Now, I was already divorced from my wife, so there's no foolishness going on here. And it's like, this is the last time, no more. Because for whatever reason, I never could shake Debbie. Just couldn't shake her out of my memory. She was always there. 2 weeks passed, hadn't heard a word. It's like, okay, we're done. I can actually close that book, and I get a phone call at work. And I'm waiting for a female supplier to call up and tell me this is really bad, bad news, and I'm not going to get what I need when I need it so that we can continue on with the progress of the job. And this voice goes, Jeff, this is Debbie. And I was like, Debbie who? Who the hell is Debbie? And I'm trying to think. I don't know a Debbie. I don't know a supplier by this name. I really don't know who this is because I'm in work mode. Then I got quiet, and I heard it again, only it was a lot slower. Jeff, this is Debbie. It's like the light bulb in this thick head finally turned on. This is Debbie Beck. I looked at the project manager of Textile, and I said, get the hell out of my office. I've been waiting to take this call a long, long time. So this is how our initial meeting went. Then we talked on the phone and agreed to actually meet. And then I find out she lives in McAllister, Oklahoma, which is 2.5 hours north of Dallas. However, she tells me that she's divorced, obviously. She has children. Okay. She had a mastectomy in May. She was done with chemo and was on the tail end of radiation, and she was bald. I didn't care. I needed to know if there was still something there. And yes, there was. I went up there. I was nervous as hell. You know, 40 plus, what was I, 45, whatever it was, 48. Yeah, 48, 49. And I feel like I'm back in high school. We picked up where we left off. We got, once again, 7 months from the time we got back together. I would lose her on July 20th. Of 2009, but it just wasn't me. Her daughters would lose her. But our relationship, the love that we had shared 30 years ago, blossomed. It was wonderful. I would do it again in a heartbeat, knowing she's going to die. That's how much I love this girl. And I loved her daughters. We had to do this as a family. And I told Debbie, as our relationship grew, I said, if your girls don't accept me, this is a failed bit. I mean, I've got 3 children of my own. And I know what it's like to bring someone in and have them fit with a lifestyle that's already been in place for many, many years. And I told her, if your girls don't accept me, it doesn't matter how we feel about each other. This isn't going to happen. It's not going to work out. And slowly but surely, they accepted me. I didn't force myself on them. I did not try and be their father. I was there to be their mother's boyfriend. And to be a male figure, not a father figure, but a male figure in their lives. And help them with whatever they needed help with. And I mean, Debbie's house was a disaster. We had to clean all that up. Relationships and cancer suck, but damn, I mean, the living you get to do, if you do it right, you will pack a lifetime of love into that relationship. And by God, I know Debbie and I did that without not a second thought. That's exactly what we did. We did everything. And when I look at the days, I mean, I'm only going up there every other weekend, and then it became every weekend. So we get 3 days a week. What's that? 12 days, seven. Hell, I can't do the math in my head right now. But, you know, 8 days a week, 8 days a month, 7 months, 56 days. That's not a lot of time, but when I recapture all this in the book I wrote just for her, Love's True Second Chance, it's just amazing everything we did in such a short period of time. Just driving around town. I mean, McAllister's not that big of a city, but there was a lot of stuff that her girls had never seen. We went to the old high school. There was a POW camp there. I mean, we went to ball fields. It was wonderful. But just because your partner or your loved one or a family member gets cancer, because I'm about out of time today, you've got to live your life and their life. Don't let the cancer control what you do. You've got to live it. I mean, I remember when Debbie was dying, when they realized her cancer was back and I saw her doctor, I saw the same look in his eyes that I did with my dad's. Debbie's terminal. There was nothing they could do about it. It was everywhere. But that didn't mean we stopped living and loving. And if you really want a good love story and a true love story, and guys, this goes for you too, because I never knew I'd be in the position that I was. The title is Love's True Second Chance. And it is a true story. What more could you want? It's not fiction, ladies. This is true love. You can follow our relationship from high school through adulthood. And we didn't get a whole lot of time together, maybe a little over two years and 30 years, but it was wonderful. And you know, the first one, Why Did Everything Happen? That is a really good book because I combined Larry, Dad, and Debbie in it. And I'm asking myself, why did these people die? Why? I get an answer, and that's on Amazon. All of my books are on Amazon. They're also, as I said earlier, jeffdawsonauthor.site. Then I have YouTube videos, if you like those, youtube.com/user/director59, where I talk about different topics, and then all the other, I have like 15 or 16 other books out there. The rest of them are fiction. But this topic was about cancer and relationships. And all I can say is, don't let it control your life. because you're not going to get a lot of time. So you make damn certain that the time you have left is used wisely. And with that, I will end today's broadcast of Dawson's Domain, and I will see you on the next one. Y'all have a good weekend. I hope you enjoyed our time together. I know I did. Without you wonderful listeners, this show would not be possible. If you want to know more about me and how my brain works, that's a scary thought, check out my books at Jeff Dawson on Amazon.com, websites LDDJ Enterprises and JeffDawsonAuthor.site for upcoming releases and teaser excerpts from past and present publications. You can also contact me at Facebook, LDDJ Enterprises Publishing, or email LDDJEnterprises@gmail.com or on Twitter at JeffDawson59. Have a great week and look forward to seeing you on the next episode of Dawson's Domain.